The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
As the Taliban grabs territory across Afghanistan, leaving the relative safety of big cities carries big risks.
To travel out, I have to have my bodyguards with me. I have to carry too many guns.
Staying put in Kabul. Also today, the Tokyo Olympics are underway and we go inside. Japan wanted a showcase of recovery from the tsunami and nuclear meltdown with a respectful welcome, or omotenashi.
In spite of all the promises that were made about the recovery Olympics and about the spirit of omotenashi, we are so far from, you know, both ideas.
And the African nation of Niger is a COVID success story, but as we know, with success comes mask complacency.
We don't have many people wearing masks, for example.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you here with us this Friday. After a year-long delay, the Tokyo 2020 Olympics are officially on. Japanese tennis star Naomi Osaka lit the Olympic cauldron at the opening ceremony today. A lot of pageantry, but a much more subdued ceremony compared to years past. A reflection of the pain and disruption we've all felt over the past year. Some of the pain for athletes today, the 68,000-seat stadium in Tokyo, was also largely empty. Just a small group of journalists and international dignitaries. First Lady Jill Biden was there representing the U.S. The famous Parade of Nations was also pretty sparse, with only a limited number of athletes taking part. The rest watched from the Olympic Village. As the world's Bianca Hillier reports, these Olympics are shaping up to be nothing like what Japan imagined when it won the hosting bid 8 years ago.
Long before the coronavirus pandemic, the Tokyo Games were already billed as the Recovery Olympics. That's got a lot to do with history, going back to the 1964 Games in Tokyo, less than two decades after World War II.
That was an occasion in which Japan tried to showcase to the world it successfully recovered and reconstructed after the devastation that was caused to Japan in the Second World War.
Koichi Nakano is a political science professor at Sophia University in Tokyo. He says back in the 60s, that messaging resonated with people. The competition was dubbed the greatest games ever, and there was a sense of national unity.
And obviously also a national sense of pride at what Japan achieved in the post-war period.
That's the spirit Japan wanted to capture when it was picked to host the Games again in 2013, just 2 years after the devastating earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster in the Northeast. Airi Ryu remembers that time. She grew up in Yokohama, just outside of Tokyo.
Japan was, as a country, in a state of a lot of sadness and a lot of loss of hope. And within all of that, there was this announcement that we were going to be able to host something that kind of brought the world together.
Politicians saw an opportunity, too. Koichi Nakano says they hoped the 2020 Games would reclaim Japan's lost status as the leading nation of Asia. Beijing had just hosted the 2008 Games, and China's economy had just surpassed Japan's.
There was a sense of mission on the part of the conservative rulers that Japan needs to be taken back. So one of the projects was to get the successful bid for the Olympics under the name of Recovery Olympics.
At the center of the bid was the Japanese word omotenashi.
In essence, omotenashi means welcoming someone with the utmost respect.
Airi Ryu says she was genuinely excited for Japan to welcome people from all over the world, just like they did in 2019, hosting the Rugby World Cup.
That was a little bit of a teaser. Rugby is nowhere near as big as the Olympics, but I think it was just an example of how we could host and showcase that part of our culture.
Now, everything has changed. Ryu shares a widely held concern that this version of the Games does not capture the omotenashi spirit. COVID has largely taken over the narrative. Officials have canceled almost all events meant to honor Fukushima, and the games have become a lightning rod for controversy.
Chief Yoshiro Mori is to resign.
The ceremony director has been fired.
The creative director responsible for the games' opening and closing ceremonies has resigned.
At this point, the whole 2020 Olympics brand appears to be tarnished for some. Toyota, a major sponsor, pulled its commercials in Tokyo. And that could be just the beginning, says Nancy Snow of Kyoto University.
It takes a company like a Toyota that has such great reputation and history to then have this spillover effect on others to step forward. So it is certainly the worst scenario for the ones who've been planning the Olympics to see that happen just days before the opening ceremony.
The games were meant to bolster Japan's reputation. But Airi Ryu is nervous about the damage that's already been done.
I feel like it's really easy to get this impression that, oh, like Japan messed up. Even though it's more complicating than that, and I would never want people to see Japan that way.
Koichi Nakano from Sophia University is also concerned about visitors coming away with the wrong impression of Japan.
There's not that much sense of hospitality, so I do hope that they don't have to go back home with a sense that this was rather disappointing. This is not what we expected, and the Japanese government told us essentially a lie that they were going to be welcomed.
While the majority of the Japanese public think the games should be called off, some volunteers are doing what they can to welcome overseas visitors. They're bringing origami and pieces of Japanese culture to members of the media who have to stay in the COVID-safe bubble and out of Tokyo streets. Still, Nakano says the initial messaging behind Tokyo 2020 is not holding up.
In spite of all the promises that were made about the recovery Olympics and about the spirit of omotenashi, we are so far from, you know, both ideas.
But the games in Tokyo are just getting started. Over the next 2 weeks, the athletes will be focused on the events they've been training for, looking to make some of their own Olympic history. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
China's President Xi Jinping made a surprising visit this week. He traveled to the Tibet Autonomous Region of China. The visit comes as Chinese authorities are looking to further control Tibet's traditional Buddhist culture and generally the region. Robert Barnett is an expert on Tibet. He's a research associate at the School of Oriental Studies in London. Tibet is always in the news on the back burner, Robbie, but this seems important. Help us understand why this visit to Tibet is so significant for China's president.
There hasn't been a visit by a Chinese president since 1990, so that's 31 years since we've seen a visit of this level to Tibet. And it comes at a very important time for two reasons. One is tensions between China and India, which are all along the Tibet border, are rising rapidly. India has just mobilized 50,000 soldiers to the border. China's probably done the same. So this is a big signal that could raise tensions along that border. And the second reason is that China's program to, shall we say, control culture in Tibet and religion is really gaining momentum now from what we can tell from the small signs of news that come out. So Xi Jinping being there is a sign that this cultural, shall we say, cultural management program is really gathering momentum.
So the signal Xi is sending to this border tension between China and India, what message is he sending?
Well, he didn't go just to the Tibetan capital, Lhasa. The first place he went to was a place called Nyingtri, which is about 300 miles east of Lhasa, much lower altitude. And Nyingtri is the main Chinese base for immigrants. That's where the Chinese like to live if they get the choice because it's lower altitude. But it's also the main military base for the troops, the Chinese troops, and it's very close to the disputed Indian border. So we have a very interesting phenomenon, a huge amount of videos being poured out of China to show this visit by Xi Jinping. They all show him meeting monks and ordinary people in the streets, very relaxed, but they don't show anything to do with the military or security or police. But probably that may have been the real reason why he was there, was to show support for the troops who are lining up against the Indian soldiers along the border, just a few miles from where he was the day before yesterday.
So meantime, in the background, how are local Tibetans and their government in exile responding to this visit?
Well, it's fascinating because the videos that China has put out show very carefully cheering crowds greeting the president or chairman as he walks through the streets of Lhasa. And it's quite remarkable because these videos are clearly about showing no security. You don't see uniformed police, let alone soldiers, although they must all be there in huge numbers out of sight. And if you look carefully, you can see these crowds are very carefully arranged and they're probably selected people and the streets are cut off. So it's all somewhat staged managed. But we don't know what anybody really thinks inside Tibet. It's almost impossible. Virtually no news comes out that can really be confirmed. But we do know what exiles are thinking. They've put out a statement. You know, there's about 150,000 exiles around the world, half of them in India. And their exile government or administration has taken a kind of low-key approach to this visit and said Xi Jinping should use this visit to understand Tibet better and begin negotiations with the exiled Dalai Lama. So the exile government, very moderate in its approach, still trying to push the Chinese to take a step towards talks that might resolve this, what is it, 70-year conflict.
Well, Robby, Tibet's witnessed massive economic development and an unparalleled infrastructure buildup in recent years. How has that effort been received in Tibet?
Well, people are very, I think, probably thrilled about the improved infrastructure, the modernization in Tibet, especially if they compare it to surrounding countries like India, Bangladesh, Nepal, and so on, where the standard of living is much lower in terms of these practical issues. But people in Tibet, they are very aware, I think, although we can't read their minds and they can't really tell us. But when we do meet them, we hear a lot of anguish, a lot of pain about what China is doing to Tibetan culture and Tibetan religion. Language is becoming less and less significant in teaching in schools. They're pushing Chinese language classes in kindergartens and in every village now. They have permanent teams of officials in every monastery and every village in Tibet. That doesn't exist anywhere else in China. So this is a control society, a surveillance society, in which now Xi Jinping is pushing Sinicization, Chinese dominance, assimilation of the culture and the religion. It won't wipe out Tibetan culture, but it will definitely make it secondary.
I mean, no doubt there is deep suspicion between Tibet and Beijing. I'm wondering, though, if Tibetans look over in Xinjiang in northwest China and see an even more bleak kind of future, one that could put them further under the thumb of Beijing. What would you say about that and the parallels between Tibet and Xinjiang?
I think that the parallels between Tibet and Xinjiang have been hugely overplayed by foreign media. And really, people have been misled about this because the party, the communists, use the same language, same terms for what they're doing, thought transformation, they call it, and so on, modernization. They now call this rural revitalization and so on. So they have these key terms and they use some of the same techniques, but in Xinjiang, they are used with maximum force. In Tibet, we do read accounts of force being used, but it's really very rare compared to Xinjiang. So the implementation of these policies is completely different in nature. And this is probably because the Chinese, like so many countries and so many people, are basically Islamophobic. They've used the American idea of anti-terrorism from 20 years ago to justify a crackdown on Islam and Islamic peoples of an unprecedented ferocity. So in Tibet, we don't see that. What we see is a slow motion, carefully managed attitude to Buddhism, which is basically corroding Buddhism. It's removing the core doctrines of Buddhism. This is quite specific, they're quite open about doing this, and replacing them with what they call socialist values. But they don't destroy the religion, and they don't put thousands of people in custody in Tibet.
Robert Barnett, an expert on Tibet and a research associate at the School of Oriental Studies in London, where he's been speaking with us from. Robert, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and thank you for covering this story.
Coming up, as Haiti comes to terms with the assassination of its president, what role should the diaspora play? It's the world.
Support for the world comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. COVID is everywhere on planet Earth. Nowhere seems safe, but some places appear to have remained largely unscathed. Consider Niger, the vast landlocked country in West Africa. 25 million people there, with more than a third of the population living in extreme poverty. But as The World's Ilana Gordon reports, Niger has had few COVID infections.
When Niger experienced its first COVID cases back in March of 2020, the country quickly locked down, shut borders, and even closed worship centers in this majority Muslim country. The government set up isolation tents and hand-washing stations. Dr. Bras Soliman has been on the front lines of these efforts. He's at the General Referral Hospital in Niger's capital, Niamey. I was mostly in charge of sorting and admitting patients, he tells me. Soliman says they've not been busy. The country has only recorded 5,500 infections and less than 200 deaths since the pandemic started. When I connect with Soliman, I can hear a fan squeaking in the background. Niger is mostly a desert and it's hot.
Actuellement, on n'a pas beaucoup d'infections enregistrées au Niger.
They're only recording fewer than 20 active cases per day, he says, and none of the infected are seriously hospitalized. Soliman says a lot of factors play into Niger's remarkably low levels of COVID.
Au Niger, notre système de vie est différent et ne facilite pas la contamination.
Our way of life is different and doesn't facilitate contamination, he says. Niger is the largest country in West Africa geographically, but it doesn't have the kind of housing infrastructure or public transportation system that leads to a lot of mixing of people. He says people live in large lots that are spread out. They often sleep outside. It's very agricultural. The population is also really young. At least half are under the age of 15. So even if many cases get missed, they very likely haven't been serious.
Yes, of course, we are relieved about that. We are glad that we don't have many hospitalizations.
Dr. Blanche Anya is the World Health Organization representative in Niger. She says it's great that hospitalizations are so low and that the government has been very proactive in its response. But it's hard to know the full scope. Widespread testing isn't happening. The positive situation might also have to do with the virus itself.
What might be circulating here might be a COVID that is not very aggressive.
The virus may not seem to be as aggressive, but if a strong pandemic response is needed, that could be challenging. Violent insurgencies, widespread poverty, and displacement are realities in Niger. Anya says it's hard to keep people thinking about COVID. Many have dropped precautions now.
We don't have many people wearing masks, for example, and where they have put this disposal for hand washing, they have disappeared. We don't see them anymore.
Researchers need to better understand the scientific and social factors that make the situation seem good in Niger right now. There's a lot to investigate. Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has a warning.
This is a very treacherous virus. I'm a virologist for over three decades, and viruses will tend to give you that false sense of complacency, seed itself into the population, and then explode.
He has watched this explosion happen across the continent, in Liberia, Uganda, Namibia, and elsewhere. Africa is experiencing its most serious surge in COVID-19 to date. At this point, he says it's very dangerous to conclude that Niger has a very unusual situation. Dr. Bras Soliman, at the General Referral Hospital in Niger's capital, is under no illusions either. Last week, the country's health minister called for greater public vigilance. Soliman says despite all the things in his country's favor, he doesn't think they're in the clear or somehow immune to COVID.
Mais devant la résurgence actuelle de nouvelles variantes, nous restons quand même prudents et nous restons toujours en alerte.
In the face of this current resurgence of a new variant, he says, we still remain careful and we still remain on alert. For The World, I'm Ilana Gordon.
Today, the funeral of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was held in Cap-Haïtien in northern Haiti. Moïse's assassination on July 7th continues to impact life in Haiti, not to mention the Haitian diaspora here in the United States. Many people in the U.S. are wondering what role they should play in shaping the future of their country. Gary Pierre-Pierre is a founder and publisher of the Haitian Times, a newspaper based in Brooklyn for the Haitian diaspora. Gary, I want to talk to you about an essay you wrote recently about the relationship between the diaspora and Haiti at this critical moment. Members of the diaspora want to play a role in shaping the future of Haiti, but that is not so simple. What is the tension you see there?
It's not simple because, you know, we out of the country. We don't live physically in the country. And so decisions are not really based on reality on the ground. That's the challenge that Haiti faces because its middle class is essentially a de facto middle class, the diaspora. Also, too, Marco, is that the diaspora has some work to be done. Its institutions are not as strong as they ought to be, as they need to be, rather, to engage it with Haiti. And so right now, the role, the primary role is that of an ATM machine, you know, just basically send money back home and help families and relatives eke out a living. And so the challenge now is to find out how can we engage meaningfully, because Haiti needs its middle class to succeed.
The fact, you mentioned this a second ago, the fact that the diaspora is largely middle class, able to send some $3+ billion back to the island in remittances a year. I mean, that middle class must also create some tension with people on the island who are not middle class.
Actually, no, because everyone has a diaspora who's helping them. Mm-hmm. The tensions come from the political class who sees that as a threat. They don't want them anymore engaged because then that creates competition. That it creates a threat that they're not comfortable giving away to what they call outsiders.
There is that diaspora that is largely middle class, as you say. I mean, much has been said over the decades about the power of the small circle of Haitian elites and the much more populous poor on the island. Can you describe what that looks like today and what impact it's having on the upheaval and tension we're seeing around the country, especially in Port-au-Prince?
You have about 10 to 20 families, maybe 25, but very small. That controls 95% of the country. Every industry is controlled by them. It's unlivable. And it starts with no wealth distribution whatsoever.
How embedded in Haiti is that economic stratification? Like, what would it take for that to even out?
All you got to do is, if you have good government, be fair, allow everybody to democratize the economy, dismantle those monopolies that are in place right now, and let it be a true free market place. And so those are the issues that I think the clear-headed members of the diaspora are saying, these are the conditions that we need to compete because we want to invest, not just come in and blow money away.
What do you think the U.S. role should be now in helping Haiti?
The U.S. has a long and complicated history with Haiti. On the one hand, they've done their best. On the other hand, they've done their worst. They've undermined the democratic process. And that has really turned off the people in Haiti from democracy. They think the system is rigged. Every time they elect someone, the United States weighs in. This is a great question, Marco, because I think this is the venue where the diaspora could exert influence if they were together. I mean, the quicker thing, you know, have a meaningful conversation with the State Department, you know, whatever other agencies that are involved, and give them the Haitian-American perspective. But the problem is the U.S. has supported the oligarchs. They have no problem with the oligarchy. But that's where the problem is. You have to dismantle that. If that's in place, I mean, I don't care how many diaspora you bring into the country, nothing's going to get done. But you have to make it a fair system where anybody can compete.
Gary Pierre is the founder and publisher of The Haitian Times, a newspaper for the Haitian diaspora. He's been speaking with us from his base in Brooklyn. Gary, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco, for having me.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. As things return closer to normal, there are parts of pandemic life we'll miss, like learning about European art with a twist or an olive.
Each Friday, this will be accompanied by a cocktail, and we will send you the recipe in advance so that you can make your own cocktail.
But alas, it's closing time at that Salon Saloon. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The U.S. launched airstrikes against the Taliban in Afghanistan this week, a move that's seen as a continuation of American support for Afghans' national forces, all while the U.S. sticks to its September deadline for full military withdrawal from the country. The Taliban has taken over more than half of Afghanistan's districts in recent months, using the tried-and-true tactic of laying siege to major cities. Now the question is, how long can Afghan security forces hold off the insurgents? From Kabul, The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
So we are on one of the main highways that lead out of Kabul, the capital. And 10 minutes drive from here is Taliban territory. This is how close the Taliban are to the capital.
I went to the outskirts of the city with a driver and a producer. First, we had to coordinate with the Afghan security forces in the area. They sent a Humvee and two pickup trucks with armed soldiers to meet us. The Afghan government's biggest concern right now is to keep Kabul and other major cities secure, because if this city falls to the Taliban, the government falls.
I think the next few months are very important for the future of this country.
Inayat Najafizadeh heads the Institute of War and Peace Studies, a think tank in Kabul. He's also a former advisor to the Afghan government.
The best case scenario is that there's going to be a military stalemate on the battlefield. The Taliban come back to the negotiating table. The worst case scenario is that the Taliban keep overrunning districts and provincial capitals, and the Afghan state collapse and the Afghan government collapse. The collapse of the Afghan government will lead to a bloody civil war.
Najafizadeh says the government security forces were caught off guard by the Taliban offensive. Its militias have been capturing district after district. He says the group has what he calls a powerful fighting machinery, bolstered by two decades of fighting experience against the Americans and Afghan security forces. And now they're using a familiar military tactic.
So what the Taliban did since April, that they have overrun key highways, key ports, neighboring districts to lay siege to key provincial capitals.
Ports and border crossings are important targets because they give the Taliban control over imports and exports. And that brings in money. Highways are worth the fight because they can limit movement and choke off provincial capitals. In the midst of this ongoing war are the Afghan people, most of them just trying to live their lives.
In Maidan, where that things are more worse than what we were thinking.
Zarifa Ghaffari works for the Afghan Ministry of Defense. Her office is in Kabul, but her fiancé and family live in the neighboring province of Maidan Wardak. So to visit home, that means she has to take the same highway I just went to see.
To travel out of my office, I have to take care of all security issues. I have to have my bodyguards with me. I have to carry too many guns. I have to commute with an armed vehicle because otherwise I will lose my life.
Ghaffari, who's 27 years old, is an example of how far Afghanistan has come in the past two decades. She grew up in a conservative part of the country, but now she holds a top position in the government. She's educated and outspoken, exactly the type of Afghan woman that the Taliban would like to keep out of power. And they've already tried to silence her. Ghaffari says she gets constant death threats. She survived several assassination attempts, and her father was murdered in front of his house last year.
I lost my dad, and I don't want to lose anyone else of my family, like my fiancé, like my siblings, like my mom.
She worries about what's next for Afghanistan. But for now, she says she's focused on her job at the ministry. Government employees have been targeted by extremist groups for a long time. But as the Taliban takes over more of the country, the fear is getting more intense. Inayat Najafizadeh with the Institute of War and Peace Studies in Kabul says he's not taking any chances.
If you're found with a contact or telephone number of an Afghan official in your phone, then you would be in trouble. A lot of cases have happened that people traveled on the highways to neighboring provinces and they were caught by the Taliban and were either kept on captivity or were executed by the Taliban.
Given that you have worked in the government, have you stopped traveling outside of Kabul?
I do. I never travel, actually. I don't travel by road.
Back on the highway, on the edge of town, we hear gunshots in the distance and decide it's time for us to leave. We say goodbye to the soldiers, whose job it is to hold off the Taliban at the gates of Kabul. As we drive back, two military Humvees go speeding past us towards the city. A soldier mans a machine gun mounted on the roof.
So they're going fast because they have injured?
A few minutes later, we find out that they're rushing an injured soldier to the hospital. For the world, Shirin Ghaffari in Kabul.
Iranians have had enough of their long drought. Specifically, in Iran's southwestern Khuzestan province is where people are protesting the severe water shortage. They say their hardships are about poor water management. For the past week, crowds of demonstrators have been met with a violent response from security forces. At least three people have died. Joining me to discuss all of this is Kaveh Madani. He's a senior fellow at Yale University and the former deputy head of Iran's Department of Environment. Kaveh, what is the extent of the water shortage in Khuzestan right now?
The system is essentially water bankrupt. Water demand is far more than the available water. Iran has been using its water resources unsustainably. Khuzestan is just one of these places where the explosion eventually has appeared. People are saying that we have had enough, and the environment is actually saying that it has had enough.
Well, just over 2 years ago, this same region of Iran was underwater, extreme flooding. How does a region exhaust surface and groundwater in such a short period of time?
It's a very good question. That part of Iran and, you know, all parts of Iran have floods and droughts. Now, this place was flooded for 2 years. They had lots of damages, but the reservoirs got full. But people forgot that they have to conserve and use less water. And when I say people, it's not really people, the government who allocates water to different uses, agriculture, domestic sector, industrial sector. And then they drain the reservoir, and now there's no rain and no water is available for the farmers to irrigate their farms, and cities are even suffering.
So what is the one big management mistake that should have been avoided to have prevented this current shortage?
Essentially, Iran is a semi-arid area. The Khuzestan province is an exception. It's very wet. It has mountains in the north. In the south, it has the Persian Gulf. But then you start putting reservoirs everywhere. You use the water for agriculture, don't supply enough water to your wetlands, don't supply enough water to the environment and ecosystem. So essentially, you are developing unsustainably.
How do you see climate change affecting and making the situation even worse?
Climate change everywhere. Heat wave and wildfires in California, floods in Germany, or drought in Iran. Climate change has a multiplier effect. Climate change increases the intensity and frequency of extreme events like heat waves, floods, and drought. So it catalyzes the problem. It exacerbates the problem. You cannot blame it as the main cause. And if you do that, essentially, you justify what is happening. This means that managers and governments don't have any liability, but managers and governments are there to forecast and predict these situations and get the system prepared and make it resilient. We have not had enough action by the governments to get us prepared for what is happening at the global scale and is making the problems worse.
Kaveh, you worked in the public sector in environmental management in Iran. What kind of reforms or reframing needs to happen for a more sustainable water situation in the country?
This economic model, which only thinks about production and doesn't think about the environment, is dysfunctional. This has been proven to us around the world. Iran must change its development model, must invest in the industrial and service sector and decrease the pressure on its natural environment if it wants to survive. This means diversifying the economy and making big reforms to the agricultural sector. And these are very, very painful surgeries that you can't do essentially in systems where people are mad at you or have lost trust and faith in the governments.
And it's not just Iran, as you alluded earlier. I mean, the next big crisis in the globe, we are told, and that is already here, is around water, shortages that are leading to monetization of water and making it less accessible to a lot of people. What does this situation in Khuzestan tell us about the future of water everywhere?
You know, we are water bankrupt in many places. The system that we have is not sustainable. Right now, what we are seeing in Iran is a political crisis. It's a social crisis. You cannot just take the environmental sector out and prescribe solutions for the environmental sector, disregarding all other governance and social issues.
Well, to that point, Kaveh, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about Khuzestan, which is home to an Arab ethnic minority that has historically faced discrimination from the Iranian government. To what extent do you think are the environmental outcomes there due to a pattern of certain groups being deprioritized by the government?
This is a very hard question to answer, you know, if this is intentional or this is a systematic failure. It's like, you know, the problem we have with the African-American communities or Black communities in the United States, that you see that, you know, there is a pattern there that inequality exists in the system and in every sector. We have the same situations with ethnic communities. The environmental injustice implications of the development projects in Iran are significant. But, you know, before I let you go, let me tell you this. You know, Khuzestan is a very rich region in terms of oil and gas. The benefits of Khuzestan were not limited to Iran. You in the United States have also benefited from the oil that this region has produced. What we didn't think about was the environmental, you know, justice implications of our aggressive economic development that was dependent on fossil energy. And now those people are left with pollution, and we are here in the United States with a much better quality of life. And I think this is something for us to consider, how our lifestyle, how what we do in Europe or in North America is affecting people in the global South.
Kaveh Madani is a senior fellow at Yale University and the former deputy head of Iran's Department of Environment. He's been speaking with us from Toronto. Kaveh, thanks for your input.
Thank you.
Catalonia, the region in the northeast part of Spain, has become a COVID-19 hotspot. The Delta variant is the reason. The European Union now recommends against all travel to Catalonia. In the region's largest city, Barcelona, reporter Jerry Haddon's 15-year-old son and a bunch of his friends caught the virus. Then Jerry and the other parents found a novel approach to the situation.
Normally, when you test positive for COVID-19, you don't celebrate. And yet that's the sound of our COVID-positive teenager, Nino, and three friends quarantining at our house in the hills above Barcelona. I'm outside the front gate, detecting a mix of trap music, PlayStation soccer, and something akin to singing. The boys got COVID at soccer camp. Normally, they would have gone straight home, but that would have meant quarantining along with any family members they've had contact with for 10 full days. Moms, dads, siblings, all stuck inside their urban apartments during a heat wave. To avoid that, we came up with an idea. I brought the boys straight from camp to our place. I'm vaccinated and had COVID just a month ago. But still, we traveled double-masked with windows down during the drive. Meanwhile, my partner, Anne, stocked the house with food. While the boys quarantined, we couch-surfed next door and checked in regularly.
¿Qué tal? Buenos días. ¿Cómo estamos? ¿Qué tal?
Everything okay? I asked them from outside the front door. The kitchen's a little dirty, our son says, but we mopped. Anyone feeling sick, I ask. Otto, you look pale. I just woke up, he says, at 1 p.m. In general, the boys seem pretty psyched, and it's no wonder. The fridge is full, there's a little pool in the yard, inside the PlayStation, Netflix, and no parents. A 15-year-old's dream.
Porque estamos cuatro chicos solos en una casa.
Because we've got the house all to ourselves, Otto says, and we haven't had to worry about getting anyone else sick. We've gone swimming and played a little soccer, adds Gabby. This is much better than being alone, which is really boring. They are on their own, but not really. As the days pass, parents take turns delivering home-cooked meals. Pau even gets a cake. It's his 15th birthday. It's an unexpected moment of happiness, of togetherness, during times of global duress and isolation. So many young people everywhere are now falling ill. In Spain, nearly half of all new coronavirus cases are people under the age of 29. Most have yet to be vaccinated. But Spain's health minister, Carolina Darias, is quick to remind young people of another problem, their own behavior.
Some of the images we've seen have shocked us. Once again, I call on young people to behave responsibly.
Darias is referring to TV reports showing all-night beach parties, parks crowded with maskless teens, getting the young to change their behavior is proving tough. The teens in quarantine at our house have their own struggle, keeping their side of a deal we made.
Nino! Make sure the house is clean. Make sure the house is clean, okay? Clean up a little bit every day so the house doesn't become a big mess.
That was day one. Things went south from there fast. But by the time the quarantine is over, the house is, how can I put it, not a total disaster? The boys found their stride. The dishes are mostly done. The floors were mopped at some point. Our dogs, alive. Maybe the young can show similar discipline outside. Surprise Spain's health minister and everyone else, remembering their masks and social distancing until they're vaccinated. It gives this dad some hope. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Many of us are cherishing what we've gotten back in recent weeks, dining and drinking in public, hugging. At the same time, there's also a sadness about what we've given up. No traffic was nice. Then there was Cocktails with a Curator, a scheme developed by New York City's acclaimed Frick Collection. For the past 60-some Fridays at 5 p.m., viewers everywhere tuned into the museum's online program, exploring the world of art. Reporter Karen Michelle was among the regulars until last Friday. She looks back at what she and the audience have lost.
Here's how the series began in April 2020.
Good evening. I am Xavier Salomon. I am the Peter J. Sharp Chief Curator at the Frick Collection. And welcome to this first episode of Cocktails with a Curator. I would like to look at some of the great masterpieces of the Frick, thinking about some of the issues we're thinking about these days. Issues to do with life, love, searching for meaning in life, and ultimately death.
If that sounds less than cheerful, there was a softening of the blow.
Each Friday, this will be accompanied by a cocktail, and we will send you the recipe in advance so that you can make your own cocktail and hopefully drink that same cocktail while looking.
My idea of a perfect Friday early evening, looking at art while drinking. An idea that resonated with more than 1.5 million viewers during the 66 weeks of the series, all recorded live, without notes, by the Frick's three curators. At the same time, there was a mighty lively and sometimes snarky, sometimes flirtatious chat room.
My name is Ian Alterman. I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I was a regular visitor. I made sure to be home and have my mocktail.
Alterman became the chat's unofficial commentator and greeter.
At first, I started to, whenever somebody would log in from another country, I would, welcome them and say, Lisbon in the house, or, Singapore in the house, or whatever.
Until it got too much, as Australia and Indonesia and Argentina and on joined in. Friendships formed in that chat space, while art and European history were learned and drinks were drunk. And you never knew what you might learn during Cocktails with a Curator, household intrigues of those in the portraits, and toxic substances they used as makeup, and technique specifics, as in Edouard Manet's painting of a bullfight in an episode hosted by curator Amy Eng.
Pure colors laid side by side as if red straight out of the tube, blacks and whites straight out of the tube, yellow, details fudged over with broad brushstrokes of paint.
Yes, sometimes the curators got excited, sometimes they did drink that beverage during the presentation, and always they told the audience stuff we likely wouldn't have known otherwise, which was the point, using art as a way to connect in a time where connections were hard to come by. Curator Amy Eng.
The genesis of the program was, well, we need to do something, but what's the right time for it? What's the time of day? Well, all of our friends are doing this happy hour. So why don't we just do a program for happy hour as if we're meeting our friends virtually?
Well, clearly the curators knew a lot about the paintings and porcelains. The beverages also needed research. Some required absinthe, others needed earthy digestifs.
I love my cocktails. I've learned a lot about cocktails, I have to say, during this time.
Chief Curator and Deputy Director Xavier Salomon.
I have to say the liquor store across my street in New York is very happy with me after this year.
Despite pleas from viewers to keep the series going, there is a book in the works. The curators are ready to get back to, well, curating, at work, not from home.
Part of it has been the sheer challenge of, I have two young children. I live in a small apartment with a very supportive but loud husband.
Fittingly, Xavier Solomon, host of the first episode, closed the series by giving thanks.
And of course, we couldn't have done it without you, all of you following us and supporting us and being so enthusiastic. And I hope we've managed to show how art can be important and is important at times of crisis, but in our lives in general.
Indeed. I never thought it would be the Frick, the formerly staid Grand Old Frick collection, that would find that sweet spot of good art, good stories, and good libations. Or now that it's Friday, that I'd miss staring at art on a computer screen, much less miss all the people around the world I've never met. Cheers. For the world, I'm Karen Michelle.
Speaking of loss, in 2004, a 20-year-old woman came to perform on Jonathan Ross's BBC talk show in the UK.
Let's get my next guest out. I think she's one of the most exciting and brilliantly talented vocalists to emerge in this country in many, many years. It is Amy Winehouse.
Amy Winehouse had just released her debut album, Frank.
Where are you from? Tell us a bit about yourself. How long have you been singing? What's going on?
I'm from Southgate. I was born in North London and... Yeah, I'm a jazz singer. You know, that's what I come from.
Winehouse was unassuming. She didn't speak with a posh accent. 10 years ago today, the world lost that rare talent when her bodyguard discovered her body in her London apartment. Alcohol poisoning, the cause. Part of Winehouse's early appeal was that she and her music were unique.
You're a very confident young woman, I've noticed. Do you get it from your mum, your dad? I mean,
I don't know. My dad's quite outspoken. Mm-hmm. He's a cab driver.
Oh, well, that's saying no more.
Yeah.
Once her follow-up album, Back to Black, came out in 2006, breaking all kinds of awards records, fame and celebrity suddenly became monstrous. As it does to so many young stars, Winehouse's confidence seemed to go someplace else. Plenty has been said about her substance abuse, the makeup breakup romances, the mind-bending pressures of show business. Today, a decade after her passing, I think we'd all rather remember her music. I saw her live only once after Back in Black came out. She looked fragile when she stepped out on stage, didn't connect with the audience, did not smile like a star. She fidgeted and played nervously with her fingers. But when she opened her mouth to sing, the confidence was all there. There's one Amy Winehouse clip in particular on YouTube that I often return to see her at the top of her game. She sings Valerie, one of several covers she performed.
Well, sometimes I go out by myself and I look across the water.
Paying our respects to Amy Winehouse today, already 10 years since she's been gone. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. The weekend is a perfect time to follow our online coverage. We'll be at theworld.org when we're not on the radio or in your ears. We'll see you there and back here on the radio Monday. I'm Marco Werman. Have a relaxing one.
I want you to come on over. Stop making a fool out of me. Why don't you come on over, Valerie? Did you have to go to jail? Put your house on up for sale? Did you get a good lawyer? I hope you didn't catch a tan. Hope you'll find the right man who'll fix it for you.